Hi, I'm Laura Kanoy, and the holiday season is a great time to take stock of the things we're grateful for, like family, a good meal, or listening to a well-told story. NHPR has been by your side all year, serving you and your community with thorough, dedicated news, right alongside moments of gratitude that offer perspective. As this year comes to a close, we hope you consider showing your gratitude by making a year-end gift. Give now at nhpr.org. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For several years, there's been heightened attention on shortfalls in our state's child protection system, and specifically on the agencies that are supposed to keep track of abuse and neglect. Now there's news of some progress, described in two separate new reports. Still, it's complicated, and the agencies and nonprofits involved have a long way to go, with the pandemic making their work even more challenging. Today in The Exchange, two leaders in these efforts are with us. They are Moira O'Neill, Director of the Office of the Child Advocate, and Joseph Ribsom Jr., Director of the State Division for Children, Youth, and Families, or DCYF. I also want to remind listeners that if you have concerns about the welfare of a child, you can call the state's Abuse and Neglect Hotline at 800-894-5533. We have that information and a lot more resources on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Well, Director Ribsom and Director O'Neill, it's great to have both of you. And Director Ribsom, let's start with you. Just remind us what your office does in terms of helping vulnerable children and families and how the pandemic has interfered with that mission.
Great. Good morning, Laura. Thank you so much for having us. So we at DCYF, we really have two primary focus areas. One is the child protection system, which we're trying to think about a little bit differently to be a more supportive agency towards families, and the juvenile justice system, which we're actually similarly trying to think of a little more differently to be a more supportive agency towards youth who are having struggles. The child protection system consists of a few parts. We assess allegations of abuse or neglect. If we do find that there's abuse or neglect, we'll get involved with that family to try to stabilize that family in place. If we can't do that, then, you know, unfortunately, sometimes children have to come into foster care. We, in that instance, try to support the family to get back together. But if that's not successful, ultimately, you know, seek to have those children adopted to find, you know, a permanent forever family. The work during COVID has gotten, you know, obviously a bit more complex because of the challenges around, you know, interpersonal contact, challenges around calls that typically would come to the child abuse hotline that had slowed down, particularly in the springtime. That seems to have picked back up to not quite normal levels, but pretty close. But, you know, all in all, I think, you know, we have a lot of really resilient people on our workforce and our provider agencies, our foster parents, who have managed to come through this really tough situation, and in some instances found ways to improve upon the work that we did previously through these challenges.
Oh, that's really interesting. So again, just to summarize how the pandemic has affected what you do at DCYF, Director Ribsom, you know, concern obviously about people gathering, staff going into people's homes and so forth. Also fewer people who normally have eyes on children in a community, teachers, doctors, you know, after school programs and so forth. But you said something there that's interesting. You said you have been able to come up with ways that are even better to do what you do. Can you just give us a little taste of that, please?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, a couple really big things that we did early on when COVID first hit was we put together what we called a child and family well-being guide, which was a resource to try to help, you know, teachers, but really anybody in the community, could be the neighbor, could be anybody, to be able to look out for families, support families and kids. And we've kind of taken that same approach to the way that we now conduct our intake. And so when somebody calls the hotline, once upon a time, unfortunately, it was kind of a binary response. You'd call the hotline and you'd either be told, yes, we're screening this in, or no, we're not. And that was the end of the conversation. And now we've been able to kind of pivot that work to provide a third option. And that third option is looking for connecting those folks to resources where maybe it doesn't meet the level of a child abuse and neglect investigation. But if we're able to look at that resource guide and say, you know, this is a family that would benefit from a family resource center, or this is a family that would benefit from one of the new kinship navigator programs, or this is a family that would benefit from a home visiting program, we'll make those connections at intake in order to make sure those families get the support they need. And hopefully we never have to hear now in the child protection system about them again.
Well, and that gets to something we'll talk about a little bit later. The idea that you're trying to move into, you know, a different mode, providing support to families before there's a crisis. I want to turn to you, Director O'Neill. What is your office's role in the state's child protection system? Your office is relatively new, formed just about 2 or 3 years ago. And how has the pandemic affected your ability to do that work?
Thank you, Laura. I really appreciate the opportunity to have these conversations about children and child welfare. I think there's a lot that goes on that many people have no idea about, which is a good thing because you don't want children to be involved in systems. But when they are, we should all know, you know, how children are being taken care of and how families are being responded to. So the Office of the Child Advocate is now about to go into its fourth year of existence. And we do essentially three things that the law requires of us. One is to provide oversight, and it has been for the last 3 years, oversight of DCYF, so that's the Child Protection and Juvenile Justice Services. And in that sense, we receive complaints from people, we investigate, we do reviews of how the system's operating. We also provide outreach and education, and that is to help people to understand how the system operates or how it should operate. We help people to navigate through the system. And one of the things that's most important is helping people understand children and child development and how to best meet their needs. And then the third thing that we do by law is to provide advice and guidance to the governor, to the legislature, and to the Oversight Commission on Children's Services so that people fully understand what's going on and how we could respond to it. All of that is couched in the requirement that we protect the best interests of children. So the COVID response, Joe Ripson has already talked about how that's changed child welfare. I mean, certainly immediately we saw the impact on children who were in the system, children who are in placement, whether it's in foster homes or in residential facilities, where they could no longer see their parents. They couldn't visit with potential adoptive parents. There were lots of obstacles because you're protecting people on all sides from a virus. And that seems like something that's difficult for us adults to deal with, but for children in careful points of development, it can be really negatively impactful on them. So we've been trying to work with the office, with the Division for Children, Youth and Families to help people understand that impact on children and to try to find good workarounds, which I think Joe's worked hard with his team to try to be more responsive. But now we're going into, you know, a heightened risk of the virus, and we're seeing kids being more and more isolated and out of their usual routines.
Yeah, give us a little bit more there too, Director O'Neill. You do focus a lot on sort of child development and informing everybody about how various struggles, traumas can affect child development. What about the pandemic? What are you seeing and informing others about the impact of the pandemic on child development? Especially children in crisis. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this is a really important thing to think about. And I'll say right up front that one of the things that we haven't done well, and since September, our purview has changed. We now have oversight of all children's services throughout the state. So that broadens our conversation a little bit more to talk about things like children's health, like prevention, like developmental services and so on. So I hope that we'll step up a little bit. And I would say the most important thing that all of us have failed to really address is the need to protect children and quite frankly, the community where the children live from transmission of the virus. We need to talk more about wearing masks, washing hands, keeping distance. And it's funny because I spoke with a mom last week who told me that her 9-year-old said, you know, why are the adults making this so complicated? Why don't they just put on a mask and wash their hands so we can go back to school? And I think that is a direction that we all need to really be thinking about. We have had since March extensive conversations about what's happening to children who are in placements, what's happening to children who are home and isolated. And we haven't just said, like, let's really sit down and put on our big boy pants and start doing what we need to do, which is very simple public health, wearing masks, washing hands, and keeping distance, because that impact on children is significant. And that impacts their parents, their families, economic stability, and everything when we're all home and isolated.
So that's kind of a holistic view, Director O'Neill. Yeah. You're kind of saying, look, if you want school to open, put your mask on. Is that your message?
It is a message. It's a simple message. And I know people take it for more than it is, but it's very, very basic public health. We know that that's how transmission happens and we can protect from it. And you have to look at the big picture, because a lot of the work that Director Ribson has been doing since he arrived here in New Hampshire has been really looking upstream at how do you support families and children to keep from coming into the system in the first place, to keep from being abused or neglected or whatever in the first place. That's well beyond child protection and juvenile justice. But this is the same argument that, you know, we're all running to think like, how are we gonna help these kids who are isolated? How are we gonna find ways to assess kids to see if they're being abused? When what we could do is get them back to normal by doing something as simple as wearing a mask, washing our hands, and keeping distance from people.
Well, I definitely want to talk to both of you about this effort to, as you said, Director O'Neill, get family support before there's a crisis. But let me remind listeners that we'd really like to hear from you too this morning. So tell us what experiences you might have with the child protection system, maybe as an employee, an advocate, a family member, or what do you want to know about how this system is supposed to work? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Director Ribson, let's talk about this. A few examples of your efforts at the Division of Children, Youth, and Families to get families help before there's a crisis, before someone calls the abuse and neglect hotline. What kind of support are we talking about?
Yeah, so there's really a ton that we've been working on. There's kind of what we refer to as kind of primary and secondary prevention. So those are activities that we try to support in the community before families even have to call, right? So those are things that we've built out in recent years around additional supports for what's called the Family Resource Centers around the state, and particularly the development of a new program called the Kinship Navigator Program, which is a program for relative caregivers who are, you know, involved in caring for their children or for their, you know, for their grandchildren, for their nieces, their nephews, et cetera, and help connect them to the different types of resources they would need around legal, around financial assistance, and things like that. The other really big shift, and this is really, in my opinion, the one of the most impactful things within the child protection system we're going to do, is the shift to offering what we call voluntary services. So that's the ability to open up and work with a family on a voluntary basis before abuse or neglect occurs without having to go to court. And we just entered into really large contracts with two really great providers, Waypoint and the Family Resource Center in Gorham. And those two providers are going to be able to open up cases to work with families who we've deemed to have, you know, a high risk of future involvement with the child protection system because of the various stressors within their lives, and be able to work with those families in a way that we at DCYF itself couldn't, to support them, connect them to the other resources they would need, identify what their stressors are, work on plans to reduce those stressors and remove those stressors, with the hope that those kids will be able to stay safe at home and never have to come into the system.
Well, that's a big deal. And I'd like to ask you just a few more questions around that. So how is that determined, Director Ribson, that a particular family is on the brink, that it has, as you put it, significant stressors that might lead to a crisis?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because in this state for, gosh, maybe a decade, we've been using tools that are kind of actuarial assessments to assess basically stressors in families called risk assessments. But for years, we didn't actually have a service to provide those families who came up as high risk. And that turned out to be about 2,000 families every year for the past decade that we knew were high risk of coming back into the system because these actuarial tools helped us figure that out. But we didn't have a place to connect them. And what's really important about this is that we now have a service to connect those families to. And I think not only does it help these families, but in the long term, it helps stabilize the system, right? It'll reduce the number of families that come back into the system multiple times, reduce the number of calls into intake, reduce the number of future assessments, and ultimately the number of kids that have to come into foster care. So it really is it's important for those discrete families in the instant, but it's also really important for the system as a whole to allow it to right size itself going forward.
So some of the stressors you're looking at, Dr. Ribsum, I'm looking, just taking from your recent report, substance abuse in the home, mental illness, learning disabilities, sort of what are some of the other issues that you look at to go, ooh, this family needs help?
Yeah, absolutely. It's those common stressors, intimate partner violence within the home. Housing stability is a huge one still.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
Housing stock in this state is pretty tight, and affordable housing is pretty hard to come by for a lot of folks. So it's, you know, it's a lot of the social needs that I think folks would think of, you know, ordinarily, if you're just thinking about the stressors that families have, it's all of those things. And as they compound, they get harder and harder to manage.
Yeah. Well, Director O'Neill, what about getting these services to families before there's a problem? That seems like the way any child protection system would want to go.
It is, and it's so important, and it's really gratifying to hear Director Ribsum talk about the expansion of voluntary services. Was when the Office of the Child Advocate came into existence, there were no voluntary services at all, and now there's a great contract with two good providers that's going to be able to really help families. And one of the things that we saw happen from the beginning of the pandemic was a drop in the number of referrals to DCYF for suspected abuse or neglect of children, and that was associated with children being out of school and not getting the same number of referrals that teachers often see. But as Director Ribsum will tell you, you know, we're still catching the kids who need child protective services. But what we're missing is a lot of the calls that come from schools often are not quite screened in as abuse or neglect, but they are those families at risk. So what schools, what teachers and school nurses and guidance counselors see are really, you know, oftentimes poverty, living with mental illness in the family, living with substance use. So there isn't an intentional abuse there, but the child is definitely at risk of heading in that direction. And so it's voluntary services that are going to be really helpful for those families. It was slow in coming. It's, you know, it was problematic with the contracting process. But at this point, we're just really, really pleased that that's rolling out now.
I have a lot more questions, but I want to go to listeners as well. And Pedro is calling from Concord. Hi, Pedro. You're on the air. Thanks for calling The Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, and thank you to the
sure.
panelists. So, well, I wanted to just start off by saying that more people in the state of New Hampshire are actually living on the line of poverty than most people believe. With that being in mind, something that Joe had mentioned, that, you know, there are provisions and there's hints to families being at risk to being involved in DCYF. And one of those provisions that I don't really hear much discussion about is free and reduced lunch. Now, New Hampshire's Hillsborough and Merrimack County has astronomically high free and reduced lunch rates even before COVID. And there was genuine, authentic fear from the state from those numbers increasing. Thus, there was a swift action to get kids food delivered to their homes during the pandemic. So one of the questions I have is, how can we use this statistic to kind of implement action, and what barriers and hurdles do the panelists see being in the way of combating the increasing or the inclining numbers for free and reduced lunch?
Oh, Pedro, I'm so glad you called. Thank you so much. This is an important point. And about a week or two ago, I interviewed the head of the New Hampshire Food Bank, Eileen Laponis, and she said demand is up 50% this year, which is really striking. So you're so right, Pedro. This is an important issue. And I'll turn to you first, Director O'Neill. Hunger, poverty, and kids in crisis often getting their best meals from school. What can you tell us about this, Director O'Neill?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Pedro. This is a really important topic because I think that New Hampshire is always rated so well, and it's such a wealthy state that people don't understand when they're hungry amongst us. And so that was a big problem when children were out of school. They were missing the meals that they were getting. And so a lot of schools did step up and offer school lunches to be picked up last spring. And with the expansion of jurisdiction of the Office of the Child Advocate, we can now look at those things and advocate for ways to address them. And I would also say that, you know, we'll hear what Director Ribsum has to say about it, but having the ability to have flexible funds when this kind of an issue, when children come to the attention of the child protective system, to be able to use flexible funds to help families with those those kinds of needs. Like, we understand that we have to help families get access to substance use treatment or parenting classes, but sometimes all families need is help with the rent and help getting groceries. And then, you know, they can carry on and take well care of their children. But those are not the kind of issues that we think of when we're thinking about child protection.
So when schools, Director Ribsum, you know, keep that free and reduced price lunch program going, when people give to their local food bank, they are in a way helping kids in crisis and maybe not get into these situations where abuse and neglect happen.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think Pedro's comment was great. And I want to kind of piggyback on some of the things Moira shared. You know, earlier when she talked about kind of disentangling notions of poverty from child protection. And I think that's a really critical issue for the state to tackle in the coming years, and really not just the state, nationally. You know, I think we see an awful lot of families present with struggles that stem from poverty, and they show up in the child protection system because there's not enough resources or support for those families to have their needs met elsewhere. And that's a pretty scary way to have to serve a family, right? If a family has to come to the child protection system where we try our best to be supportive, but at the end of the day, we do have a lot of authority over families. We have the authority to go to court. We have the authority to remove kids. And that's not an easy way for a family to reach out for help, right? They need to be able to reach out to some community resource, somebody in their neighborhood, somebody that they know and trust that doesn't have that kind of, you know, that scariness behind them. And that's, I think, really a key thing that we're trying to disentangle right now. And Director O'Neill is part of a team that's looking at that issue with us in New Hampshire. But it's really, I think, a central national conversation right now, these issues of disentangling poverty from what child protection is, which is really about protecting kids where the parents don't have, where the parents are not able to meet the needs, not because of poverty, but because of some other struggles that are really, you know, beyond what we can control. So I think picking those things apart is really key. I think another really key thing is looking at the data, like what Pedro spoke about, and using that data to inform where we set up different types of preventive interventions, right? Where you support your family resource centers, where you support home visiting programs, where you support those types of things to keep kids and families strong without ever having to call us.
And you mentioned, Director Ribsum, that those services are voluntary. You really hope people will use them so that the family doesn't end up in crisis. I wonder, though, piggybacking on what you just said about sometimes people being afraid of DCYF, is there a psychology against asking for that kind of help that you mentioned because you don't want to sort of flag yourself for possible deeper intervention?
I think that's a fear that exists, but I do think it's an unfounded fear, right? Because if we were to get involved and see a family that's actively working to solve these issues, you're going to get, you know, nothing but support from the child protection staff who go out and come across that situation. Because our number one goal is to try to keep kids safe and intact with their families. And that's really important because we know that every time you remove a child from the home, almost no matter what's happening in that home, it's going to be traumatic for that child. And every time our staff have to make that decision, they're really having to balance the trauma that's going to suffer, that child will suffer from removal, against the trauma that child is suffering by remaining in the home. And the best way to deal with that situation is to prop that family up, support that family, and keep that child safe at home. So I'd hope that folks aren't afraid of seeking help because of fear for child protection, because I think what that shows, if you're seeking help, if you're trying to do what's best for your family, if the Child Protection Agency gets involved, we're going to see that, and that's going to be something that's going to help us keep you and your family intact.
Well, that gets to the foster care system and some of the changes there, especially due to the pandemic. And I'd like to ask you both about that after a short break. We'll also keep taking your calls. So join us like Pedro did with a phone call at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Also, if you do have concerns about the welfare of a child you know, you can call the Abuse and Neglect Hotline at 800-894-5533. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire's Child Protection Services. Two new reports portray the state making progress in some areas and lagging in others. Meanwhile, though, the pandemic has brought many new challenges, and we're hearing about those. And Exchange listeners, what questions or personal experiences do you have with the child protection system? What do you want to know about how it's supposed to work? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, use Twitter, or call 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. So just before the break, we were starting to get into foster care. So again, Director Ribsom, as head of the Division for Children, Youth, and Families, this is right under your purview. What's the status of foster care right now, especially given that with the pandemic, we're not supposed to be bringing people in from outside our own home group?
Yeah, thank you for the question, and it's so important. I mean, I think the good news is that we've been able to continue recruiting and licensing more foster parents during this period. We've had to get some exceptions to our standard rules for certain things like fire inspections, where we had a hard time getting those things done because early on in the pandemic, fire departments weren't able to go into the homes to do those things. Those issues are really behind us now. But we have also had a hard time recruiting, right? Because the typical recruitment approach to bringing in foster parents is you go to community events, many of which have been curtailed. So we've had to move to more, you know, kind of direct marketing type recruitment. But the good news is we've still been bringing on more foster parents. We actually have more foster parents today than we ever have had.
Really? Now,
yep.
I'm really surprised by that. I would think people would be sort of holding up on their own.
Yep. No, we're getting lots of really great support. I think it just speaks to the generosity and the care that the folks in New Hampshire have. It's remarkable how many people are, you know, ready, willing, and able to step into that. That being said, we still need more, and we need more in certain areas, right? There's lots of folks who are ready to work with, you know, a healthy young child, but that's not most of our population that we need to serve. You know, we have a lot of adolescents. We have a lot of larger sibling groups, and we really need foster parents who could focus on those two areas, you know, caring for an adolescent who maybe has had some challenges and has had some trauma and needs, you know, some extra support. And that's, while it might be a tougher situation to work in, it's an incredibly rewarding situation to work in as well. And those kids certainly need the stability and love of a family unit. And that's, you know, so if I was asking for people thinking about foster care, particular those two areas, sibling groups and adolescents, is huge.
Yeah, and Director O'Neill, from your perspective as, you know, the head of the Office of the Child Advocate, what are the trends that you saw either in your recent report or in the DCYF recent report about the status of foster care?
Thank you. Yeah, we're really pleased to hear the news that they're able to recruit more and more foster parents. This is a really important role, and we've been advocating for that. I would say one of the issues is that oftentimes there are accomplishments in the agency that aren't spread throughout the agency. So we still hear from, you know, caseworkers and supervisors that there just aren't enough foster families. So being able to really spread that news and make sure that everybody is aware of where resources are and what's available is important, because, you know, just hearing the news that there's more foster parents than ever is really exciting, and it's positive, and it's motivating. And so that's the kind of information that needs to be spread more widely. I would say that the cases that often come to our attention tend to be those involving adolescents. And a lot of adolescents who are involved in the juvenile justice side. You know, we talk a lot in the news about child protection in the context of child welfare, but DCYF also runs all the services for the juvenile justice side. And we've seen more and more cases that are involving children who are sort of chronically neglected or abused, who end up shifting over to the juvenile justice side. And then that shifts the locus of accountability for those children from their parents to the children themselves. And a lot of those children may stay home and have, you know, the majority of them stay home on probation and they get supervised. But a good number of them are in residential treatment facilities, or there's a small number at the Sununu Youth Services Center incarcerated. We don't really often think about what they really need is a stable home, a foster home where they can do the work they need to do, and someone can also work with their parents so they can reunify the same way you do on the child protective side. So I would encourage as we're recruiting more foster homes, for adults to think about fostering adolescents. You know, I really enjoy talking with the teenagers that I meet who come to our attention. They're pretty smart kids, but they've had a rough time and they've been held responsible for things that they really don't have the capacity to be responsible for. And it's a pretty gratifying group of young people to work with.
Give us a little bit more there, Director O'Neill, for people who aren't as directly involved in this as you are. The idea of when a teenager is moved from the child protection system to the juvenile justice system, as you said, it puts the responsibility on the child instead of on the parent. That's really interesting. So just give us an example or a little more specificity on what you mean there.
Sure. This is a system problem that came to our attention in the past year. We started doing these individual child case reviews, especially around the COVID situation, because we were advocating for children not to be placed in residential congregate settings because of the high risk of exposure.
Sure.
And so we started looking at their cases to help the agency see, like, does this child really need to be placed in a facility, or, you know, what's going on with this child and could they stay home safely? And what we found, almost 100% of the cases, I think we did about 14 or so of them, they were all children who started out on the child protective side. And they had, you know, it might be a case of poverty where parents just couldn't, they couldn't get stable housing, or it might be a case of parents who had substance use disorders, but somehow, you know, the child was continually living through these adverse childhood experiences with their families. I mean, what happens is children, that really affects a child's development. It affects their brain development. It affects their way that they interact with the world. And we start to see them communicating through behavior. One of those behaviors is, you know, particularly amongst girls, is they run away. So girls can be arrested for that. You know, they run away, they might steal something, or they might get into an altercation with someone or misbehave in the public. And rather than saying, like, why is this child running away? We try to get the child back with the family. When that doesn't work, eventually the police are called because maybe someone, you know, throws something at their parent or they get into a physical fight. Parents are exhausted. They don't have they're just not equipped to understand what's going on with their child or the impact of the family dysfunction on them. And so now, if it was a child protection case, the court would be involved and required the parents to do certain things, go to substance use rehab, go to parenting classes, see a therapist, do family therapy, and it would all be on the parent. But when a child is shifted over to juvenile justice, then the child goes to court and they are exposed to, you know, rules of probation that require that they behave in a certain way, that they go to therapy, or they go to a residential treatment program. And you can do all the work you want with a child in a residential program, but the child still has the same family who is now not necessarily, often families can be offered services, but they're not court imposed the way they might be on the child protection side. So there's a big effort. I'm on a team with Director Ribson and others that looking at changing probation and making it more supportive, more coaching, you know, more helpful in a developmental perspective. But currently now we're seeing, you know, children who are shifted over, and those in children are invariably are the ones where, you know, they can't really return home, and they don't belong in the residential programs. And the longer they're there, the more provocative those settings are to them. And we do see a small number of them end up at the Sununu Center that could all be avoided if they could have sort of a safe home where they can rest for a while. And we always promote the model of fostering both the child and the parent.
That's a really interesting, that's a whole nother show, Director O'Neill. And it's very interesting, kind of shifting the way that we look at children who are quote unquote acting out. That's how people used to call it. And you know, changing our mindset around that to perhaps better help young people. I want to go back to some of the details in the recent reports that you both put out, because they do relate to this overall ability of the state to take care of its most vulnerable children. And as both of you know, one huge obvious problem for a long time has been the caseloads that child protection workers had. At one point, they had to keep track of 45 families. From what I understand from the recent report from DCYF, it's now at about 16. Here's an email, though, that we received from Demetrios, who works in the Manchester DCYF office. He says he's been there 9 years. He says caseloads have come down, which is a good thing. The job of child protection service workers who investigate reports does remain very challenging in that the reports we are getting now seem to be more serious and complex, and we have to take more steps to follow up in order to close them, which is leading to more overdue reports. Voluntary cases, which have been great to offer families, have also ended up being the responsibility of assessment workers after we were first told that family service child protection service workers would manage them. So morale declines and progress is made in one area, but more tasks get assigned to another. Also, finally, Demetrios says COVID has definitely taken a toll on workers. There's always some inherent risk in our job, but it's so much riskier now because of the coronavirus. We were told to make in-person visits concerning only more serious reports or situations, but at times it seems safety has taken a backseat to our improving our stats, and we sometimes feel we are forced to go into unsafe situations. I would like to know if Director Ribsum has any thoughts on these issues. And Demetrios, thank you very much for writing. And there's a couple points that he makes in there, Director Ribsum. One is, he says it's great that the, you know, that each caseworker has much fewer cases to look at, but that the reports he's getting now seem to be more serious and complex. I wonder what you think about that, Director Ribsum.
Yeah, you know, and I think a lot of those things happening are actually signs of the system progressing to where it should be, right? So we had actually, if you go back to 2016, the average assessment worker was carrying over 90 cases, which is just unfathomable. When I first got here, it was in that mid-40s number that you mentioned, and I think today it's somewhere around, you know, the mid-teens. Our goal is that caseloads should be closer to 12 for our assessment staff. And when you have a caseload of 12, the expectation around the workload accompanying those cases does shift a bit, right? It's not simply about completing an assessment and identifying what the risks are, but then it's about how do you help stabilize that family within that time period. And if you're juggling 45 families, 90 families, even at 17, it's really hard. You really don't have the bandwidth to do that type of work with a family. But the point of getting caseloads down to 12 is that staff actually would have the time then to engage with families in a meaningful way, try to identify what their challenges are, and connect them to the supports they need. And that's really where this concept of voluntary services that we just spoke about comes in. So one of the things that Demetrios raised was the challenge of managing voluntary cases in-house, especially when you have caseloads that are higher than they should be.
Right.
So the reason why we put out this idea of community-based voluntary services with a community provider, really two big reasons why we chose to do it in the community rather than in-house. One, because we didn't have the in-house capacity. So even though a couple years ago we were given the legal authority to work voluntarily with families, we didn't have the staff to do it. So we could only serve a handful of families, only really those highest risk situations where we were fearful that something really bad would happen if we didn't intervene. The other reason was because community providers are less scary to families, and we think families are going to be more likely to engage and work with them. But other systems don't work
that way. Oh, that's interesting, like Waypoint.
Exactly. Right, but other systems don't work that way. Where I came from, I was in New Jersey for a decade before I joined the New Hampshire team 3 years ago. And our comparable service to voluntary services was actually run by our own caseworkers, in-house staffed. But we also had 3,600 frontline staff compared to a few hundred in this state, right? New Jersey is a bigger state per capita, but it would be the equivalent of us having about 500 or 600 frontline staff compared to
wow.
just under 300 that we have right now.
Well, can we talk a little bit about turnover, Director Ribsum? Yeah. I know that, you know, this has been a big issue. You've had a lot of open positions for a while that the legislature funded, trying to fill those. But at the same time, there's a lot of staff turnover. I wonder why you think that's happening and what you're doing about it.
Yeah, so it is an area where we're seeing improvement, but it's something that's going to improve slowly. I think when we talked to staff about the pressures, the number one thing people said for years was caseloads were unreasonable, unmanageable, which put too much pressure on them and made them feel like they couldn't be successful in working with families. And it's such a hard job to do if you're not able to feel successful. So by reducing caseloads, we think we're going to be able to drive down turnover pretty significantly. In a large organization, you try to target something like about a 10% turnover rate. This past year, the total turnover rate was somewhere around 20%, but about 3% or so of those were people who were actually promoted from within. So when we received a bunch of new positions in this last legislative session, a lot of those were for frontline staff, but a lot of those were also for new supervisors. And those new supervisors were filled by frontline staff who were promoted. So that kind of exacerbates the frontline staffing issue. But at the end of the day, what that ends up doing is creating a stable system, provides opportunities for people to grow professionally within the organization, and provides good, strong leadership within the organization to help all those new staff who are coming on board. But I've lived
because
through
they've been in that position. Yeah,
exactly. And I've lived through this before in another state, right? We went through the same exact exercise, 15 years ago in New Jersey. And it takes a number of years to really just go through this process of continuing to hire, continuing to promote, until you finally get to the point of stabilizing your system. And it's because we've started so deep in a hole, right? When you're talking about caseloads in the 40s or 90s in 2016, that's a really deep hole to dig out of. And I think we've made remarkable progress, but obviously there's still more room for improvement there.
Well, and Director O'Neill, Demetrios wrote to us. What do you hear from staff at DCYF? How much are they calling the Office of the Child Advocate?
We do hear from staff more and more on a variety of issues, but of course we've been watching the workforce change over the past 3 years, and it is moving in a positive direction. I guess the message would be that we're not done yet, and it's an awkward conversation to have in the middle of a pandemic when we're looking at austere budget cuts, but we do need to keep building on the staff at DCYF. And you asked about turnover, but the other thing is also that Joe Ripson is staffing up to just barely what he needs. He doesn't have any kind of a fallback for when staff are in training. So right now he's hired a bunch of people, but a good percentage of them are in training, so they're not in the field, or people who go out on medical leave. And we've certainly seen a lot of people going out on medical leave under the pandemic. And so we've suggested having some kind of a pool of workers who can move around the state when one particular district office has staff who are out for whatever reason, and they can keep sort of that flow going and keep the workloads at an even pace. But again, that requires, allocating more funding and having the resources available. And then the other piece of that is that we're still waiting to roll out the community-based services that are going to support families and be a place for all these caseworkers to bring families to. You have a caseworker or a case manager, but they have nothing to manage if there's no array of services to bring children and families to. So we do have the community-based services rolling out for a particular part of the of the population. There is an RFP finally for mobile crisis response. We're still waiting for other services that will help children. And those are all, a good year and a half overdue from when Senate Bill 14 was passed and the budget allocated for enhanced services that we haven't seen. And so those things, particularly in the environment of a pandemic where we see that in needs of families increase really at a rapid rate that would keep them all out of the child protective or juvenile justice system if only they existed now. So it's really right. Building in all directions. It all costs money.
Yeah, well, since both of you raised the issue of resources, we will pick up that thread after a short break. And listeners, it's been good to hear from you. Keep your calls and emails coming in. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I also want to refer you to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We have all sorts of numbers and resources there, including the number for the abuse and neglect hotline here in New Hampshire. So lots of resources at nhpr.org/exchange. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, two leaders of New Hampshire's child protection system are with us, the directors of the Office of the Child Advocate and of the Division for Children, Youth, and Families, or DCYF. And listeners, join us with your stories and questions. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call 1-800-892-6477. 6477. And Director Ribsum at DCYF, this next email is for you. It's from Aaron, who says, I'm always hearing about underfunding causing cases, some tragic, to slip through the cracks at many social service agencies. Compared to the funding you get now, how much more funding would you need, both percentage-wise and real dollars, to create manageable caseloads and provide good salaries for your caseworkers and employees? Aaron, thank you very much. And Director Ribsum, it is budget season for state agencies. You guys are putting together your budgets to present next year. So how would you answer Aaron's question?
Great. Yeah, and thank you so much, Aaron, for the question. I think, you know, what's really positive is that when we put together the staffing numbers that we anticipated that ultimately ended up in what was called Senate Bill 6 in the last session, that was based on an analysis of what our actual call volume was and assessment volume was. So once those positions are filled, I do think we're going to be in pretty good shape. I think there could be some benefit to looking at ways to provide a little more flexibility, like Moira was talking about. We had, back when I was in New Jersey, a unit that did that, we called them an impact team, who would go from, you know, office to office to cover when there were particular challenges, because when you have a statewide system, things pop up in different areas at different times. But I think, you know, I do think that the staffing levels that were put forward in Senate Bill 6 that are currently funded and that we're just feverishly working to fill and train are adequate. But to get us to the caseloads that we projected, right, those caseloads of 12 for what we call our assessment staff and 10 for what we call our family service staff. But we're probably, you know, a good year or so away from hiring, training, and getting to a place where all of those positions are full and stable.
Where do you tend to find your new employees, Director Ribsum? You know, given New Hampshire is one of the older states in the country, so I'm just wondering, are people coming in from other states? Are you finding a good pool of potential employees at the state universities? Are people choosing second careers, you know, middle-aged folks? Where are you getting people from?
Yeah, you know, it really is a tremendous mix. We do obviously get a lot of folks who are, you know, recently out of undergrad, who studied social work or related disciplines. And some of that comes through a program that we have, an internship program we have with the state universities to support youth or support college students engaging in internships with us while they're in school and then moving into a role with us for a couple of years afterwards, and hopefully that turns into a long-term relationship. But we've also seen people, you know, I have a retired police officer from another state who retired and came up here and just wanted to do this work. We have retired teachers who've decided that they wanted to step into this work as a second career, and folks who come from other social service agencies. So I think it is a mix of people that come into these roles, and they're not all, you know, young, just fresh out of college, although there are quite a few of those folks too.
Oh, that's interesting. All right. Well, Aaron, thank you for writing. And let's take another call. This is Deli in Concord. Deli, you're on the Exchange. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
First
of all, I just want to say thank you to Directors Ribsum and O'Neill. The work that they have done to improve the system for children in New Hampshire has been nothing but remarkable. So I applaud what they've done. I noticed Dr. O'Neill mentioned the community-based system, and I do know we have a law in New Hampshire, 135F, that says we are to build out the community-based system to keep families together. What can we as advocates do to ensure that that system is built out in a timely manner? I know we had talked about multisystemic therapy coming to New Hampshire. I haven't heard anything more about that. I think that would be a great program. So I want to know how I can work with my advocates to ensure that these services get put in place sooner than later.
Yeah, Deli, I appreciate the call, and it raises something that I was thinking about while both of you were talking a moment ago, and Director O'Neill turned to you. I mean, it's one thing for you guys to say, well, this family needs mental health services, or this family needs substance abuse services, and so forth. But if those services aren't there, you know, the advice really isn't worth much. So what about Deli's point? Deli, thank you for calling in.
That's true, Laura, and thank you, Deli, for the call. I think it's probably one of the key questions of the day, because we have to have a system in order to make it all work. And we really felt like very positive when Senate Bill 14 passed and when the budget in 2019 passed, giving Director Ribson a good amount of funds to redesign the whole system, including the residential care. And yet it's been very, very slow. We were told in the beginning that there was a problem with staffing in the contracts office. You have a huge sort of rollout of lots of services, building a whole system back up from what was almost nothing for a while. And it's still dependent upon a small office of people in the greater Department of Health and Human Services that's responsible for all contracts and requests for proposals and things. We're now told that they are staffed up. But it's those delays that I think really are a problem, and particularly we're feeling it in the pandemic, because if we don't have the services and the supports for families, then if there is a crisis, it grows to a larger degree. And that's why we saw, and we mentioned in our annual report, you know, historical number of children backed up in emergency rooms waiting for services that probably could have been diverted altogether had they had mobile crisis response in their home.
For mental health services, right, Director O'Neill? That's what you're talking about?
Yes.
So just to clarify, the problems with the mental health system means you can refer families or children to mental health services because you've, you know, determined that that's what they need. But then if there's nothing there, they just end up in the emergency room. And that's definitely something that we've been tracking and looking at on the exchange. Just a couple last questions for both of you, and then we have to close out. Director Ribson, to you first, getting back to Aaron's point in our conversation about budgets, the pandemic has hit state revenues hard. You know, rooms and meals taxes are certainly down. Other sources of state revenue are down. How concerned are you that your agency might face cuts?
You know, I think we've been really, really fortunate in the Child Protection Agency to get really broad bipartisan support, really since I first got to this state. You know, under Republican governor with a Republican legislature, under Republican governor with a Democratic legislature, we've continued to see that support grow. And what I've heard from legislative leaders so far is that maintaining, you know, this progress that we've made and continuing to build on it's going to remain a priority into the next budget. So I believe that that's true, and I'm certainly going to be advocating to ensure that that's true. Because as you know, as you heard from Deli and as you heard from Moira, right, the progress of implementing and building systems takes much longer than people would like to recognize and that people would like to have happen, right? I think it's just a really complex process to build systems that frankly a decade ago were really taken apart. And it's happening. The progress is happening. It's just happening not quite as quickly as we'd all love to see. So I think it's really, really imperative for our policymakers to kind of keep their foot on their gas and to let us continue to do this work, to continue to build out these supports, to keep kids and families out of the deep end systems and get them the help they need before they end up into our deep end child protection and juvenile justice systems.
And again, next year, that's when you will be presenting, right, Director Ribson? Correct me if I'm wrong. You'll be presenting more specifics. This is what we need. This is what we're doing and so forth.
Yep. That's right.
That's how the process works. Yeah. Director O'Neill, in your new report, you say that in 2021, New Hampshire can expect your office to promote, quote, an elevated voice of children themselves as we move to engage them in self-advocacy. I thought that was really interesting, Director O'Neill. What does that look like or sound like?
Thank you. I think that's probably one of the missing elements here in New Hampshire. I have to echo what Joe Ribson said in the fact that children are absolutely a priority across the aisle. We've always had bipartisan support. This is one issue in New Hampshire that gets really true bipartisan support, which is very gratifying. And so one of the things I think that's important as we continue to move forward, and we don't want to exhaust the legislature or the governor with investments in children, is for them to come to have a better understanding about children themselves. There's a lot happening in transforming both the child protection and the juvenile justice systems. We had experts here a couple of years ago who gave us some, you know, two or three really specific recommendations for transforming juvenile justice. And the number one was get children involved themselves. We have to hear their voices. And this goes across the country and even internationally. This has been a focus of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, is to have children share their experiences. This is how we come to know what's happening. And I have to tell you, I find children, particularly those who are deep in the system, they really get the system and they know what's not working. But when you ask them what we should be doing, they're not always prepared to tell you because no one has asked them before. And that's the most common thing that we hear from children. We say, what do you want? Where do you want to be? They say that they hadn't thought about it because no one had asked them. But when you do ask them, you get some really good information and you generally get a plan that's going to be workable. And so we're looking forward this year to building some alliances across several groups and just getting young people involved and talking about what their experiences in systems and how we can improve them.
Wow. So will you have sort of an advisory council or something? Maybe not that formal, Director O'Neill, but a group of young people with experience in this system telling you what they think you should do.
Sure. Right now we're focusing on the juvenile justice side of things because there is advocacy for lots of things happening on the child protective side, but the juvenile justice side is left sort of very quiet. We never hear from children or parents. And so we're working to help organize an actual organization of self-advocates. And we're using models like the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance, where it's an advocacy organization, much like New Futures advocates around children's behavioral health. But in this case, in Connecticut, they actually pay young people to advise the legislature. You know, it is a job, and they're called justice advocates. And those are the sorts of people that we want to be able to really inform policy in the state.
Well, that's really interesting. And we will close it out there. But Moira O'Neill, I really appreciate you being with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Moira O'Neill, Director of the Office of the Child Advocate. And Joseph Ribsom, thank you also for your time. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. Thank you. And everyone be well and safe.
That's Joseph Ribsom, Jr., Director of the State Division for Children, Youth, and Families. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.